Hello, it's Ben Burrell here. I hope you're doing all right. Hope all is good in your world. It's been a while since we last spoke, hasn't it? I was just trying to think, actually, before I started recording. What has happened? What major thing? What's the number one thing that's happened in Bob's world since we last did this podcast? And I'm struggling to think. There's been lots that have happened. All I can think about, though, is him hitting a wrench against a microphone. Do you remember that? Did you see that on social media? It went viral a while ago now. But it was a strange occurrence at a live show. Probably has never happened before. Probably will never happen again, I'd imagine. That's why I'm doing this entire half an hour show on why Bob was hitting a wrench against a microphone. No, that's not happening, sadly. What I thought it would be nice to do is bring you some Patreon episodes. We did Patreon for a while on this podcast. Thank you if you subscribed, by the way. What a joy it was. You enabled me to make the show even better, and it was such a joy to do that. I thought enough time has elapsed now between us finishing the Patreon episode to bring some onto this feed, and I wanted to bring the episodes we did on Patreon on Oh Mercy to this feed, because the episode on Oh Mercy that we did on the Bob Dylan Album by Album podcast was a little bit light, because it was, for want of a less grandiose term, a pilot. I was just trying to kind of work out what the podcast would be, how it would sound, and I didn't do as much kind of extensive deep diving into Oh Mercy as some other albums that came later. And that's one of my favourite albums, Oh Mercy, if not my favourite record. So I thought it'd be fun to bring you these episodes on this record that I feel we didn't cover enough on the original podcast. And we've really gone to town on it, because it's a multi-part episode on Oh Mercy. So here is the first part of this multi-part episode look at Oh Mercy. We're going to look at the early stages of the recording process for the album and the first two songs that were recorded on the record. What a joy it is to be back with you. Enjoy these special Oh Mercy episodes. Here is part one. Let me set the scene for you. It's late. Bob Dylan is sat in a large dining room. Outside a window to his left is a huge tanker slowly making its way across the Pacific Ocean's horizon. He has a phone in his hand. He's pressed it tightly against his ear. He waits, and a voice on the other end says,
"Hello."
Dylan didn't know it then, but his career was about to change forever. And change for the better. On the other end of the phone was producer Daniel Lanois. As a French-Canadian, Lanois' first introduction to music was, of course, through the penny whistle. What else? He wanted to learn the clarinet after seeing the instrument on TV. He had purchased what he thought was one, or at least something similar to it, after seeing it by chance in a music store window. Despite it not having the clarinet sound he so desired, Lanois put it to good use. He played little melodies. He even developed his own notation system for it. He, by all accounts, fell in love with that penny whistle. And that was his first introduction to music. His producing career started young as well. He cut records with local artists in a basement studio in his mother's house when he was still a teenager. This is all in Ancaster in Ontario. Lanois' style mixes acoustic music and vast soundscapes. He manages to install a beating heart into electric music, a phrase that Dylan would later use for one of their collaborations. He would make his name in an international sense working with Brian Eno. Eventually, the pair made albums for the band U2, starting with 1984's Unforgettable Fire. It was, of course, lead singer of U2, Bono, who introduced Lanois to Bob on that night in his dining room with that tanker on the ocean in the background. After a dinner party where Bob had had some friends over, everyone had gone to bed except for Bono and Dylan. They stayed up late and they hatched this idea. Bob had been writing a lot of what would turn out to be Oh Mercy by this stage, but his career was definitely in a difficult spot, despite a purple patch of that writing. The forced dawn of a comeback in the form of the Infidels LP had come and gone, and he was once again left, destined to become a heritage act. In fact, at this time, by many accounts, it was even unfashionable to be a Dylan fan. The thought of a modern Dylan album felt like something to navigate rather than enjoy. But how do you turn a thing like that around? Well, it's almost impossible. It's the same old story, I'm afraid. Dylan was a big star, perhaps not in terms of having hits at this point anyway, but he'd obviously done so much in his career, redefined so many boundaries, so was probably rightfully still being treated like that big star. No one was going to tell Dylan what he should or shouldn't be doing with his records, so things like Empire Burlesque happen. But also Bob and his management team had to arrest this decline. Bob's career could have easily become a thing that only existed from the early 60s through to the early 80s. Bob being Bob meant he was always pushing on to the next thing, whether that was going electric or going gospel or going to Nashville. He'd always taken that step, but for the first time in his career, at this point, things felt like they were at a dead end. What even would a modern Bob Dylan album sound like at this point? Well, we'd seen various attempts at it, with various amounts of success. So that doesn't really feel like an option for this particular album. It needed a new approach. It needed a new idea, something less obvious, perhaps. And thankfully, Daniel Lanois would have one. Lanois's working environment was to set up a mobile studio wherever it was convenient for the artist. Before the Oh Mercy LP, he'd made an album for the Neville Brothers. It was titled Yellow Moon. This was cut in a New Orleans apartment with the control board in the same room as the musicians, without a screen between them, and Lanois sat literally in front of the musicians directing the sessions. Bob saw this firsthand. He had visited the makeshift studio when he was on tour in Louisiana in 1988. He went partly because the Nevilles were covering two of his songs, The Ballad of Hollis Brown and With God on Our Side, the latter of which features a killer vocal. But Bob had also partly gone to see how Lanois worked. He liked what he saw. He told Daniel it sounded like they had a record, and Bob wanted one too. Before that could begin, though, Lanois would have to hear the songs. He went to Dylan's house to hear what would make up Oh Mercy. There, for the first time, he was treated to songs like Most of the Time and Everything is Broken. He proposed they head to New Orleans when Dylan was ready, and Lanois would arrange everything before he arrived. Initial sessions, or perhaps we can call them pre-sessions, were held in that same New Orleans apartment the Neville Brothers had used, but they ended up needing a little more space, so Lanois rented a five-story house at 1305 Sonnet Street in uptown New Orleans. It had a brick drive and a wooden frame, and there was a pool in the back. It couldn't have been further from a recording studio. He set up the soundboard in a large ground floor room with the musicians arranged in a horseshoe configuration around him. Things started out in a pretty straightforward fashion, but as the sessions went on, no work was done in the day. This became a nighttime record, written and recorded at night. The studio was predominantly Dylan sat opposite Lanois, each with a guitar. There was, as Lanois calls it, a rolling 808 keeping time, with a big speaker playing the whole thing back to Dylan. An 808 is a drum machine that allows Dylan and Lanois to have every track in time, so they could build on top of it. The idea being that Dylan could give his producer the centre of the song, and Daniel could put whatever he wanted around it. As Lanois says, if I wanted Bob in Starlight, I could have it. If I wanted him with Bamboo behind the song, I could have it. It was a blue screen. Lanois told the Q on CBC programme in 2021 that Bob doesn't like to waste time in the studio. My tendency to experiment wasn't part of his makeup, he said. So, with the vocal delivery and guitars from Bob recorded face-to-face with Lanois, he could then experiment with the tracks. Lanois said Bob was particular with the words. One day they'd cut a track and the next Bob would come in and inform his producer that he'd changed the lyrics. Again, this is the beauty of the 808's recording. They could drop in a verse here or pull one there if they needed to. There's some confusion about what happens when in the studio. Dates are different from a few sources, which isn't too surprising. This wasn't a conventional studio after all. There wasn't many staff attached to the building logging everything that happened. But I'm going on Michael Krogsgaard's Bob Dylan, The Recording Studios, Part 9. Michael has been into Columbia's vault to look at tape logs on a special request, so his information is as good as any. It looks like the first song they tackle is Born in Time. This happens on the 28th of February 1989. It wouldn't make it onto the album. Although they get it pretty sharply in the studio, they give it three goes. The first two end up on the Telltale Signs bootleg, and of course the song, in a different incarnation, an inferior one in my opinion, ends up on the Under the Red Sky album. The song must have been in contention for the record, though, as they return to it for overdubs on the 7th of March and the 13th of April, as Dylan adds some more vocals. Lanois then overdubs some 12-string guitar on the 29th of March, and there's more guitars, this time from Bob, coming on the 7th of April, so a fair amount of work went into the song. The two versions that end up on Telltale Signs both feature a great vocal from Bob. The second one has a nice little instrumental section after the 2.5 minute mark, and some more 80s sounding guitars that drift in and out of the mix. The third version of the song has not been officially released as of yet. A few days after cutting the bones of Born in Time, they were back in the house studio, and two more songs emerged from the session and onto the album's track listing. They are What Good Am I and Ring Them Bells. The first of which, for me, always feels like a centre point of the record. In fact, they both do. Not just because this song comes in the middle of the record, but it also feels connected to the album's title, Oh Mercy. It gives the impression of looking for redemption. Mercy, by its very nature, is compassion or forgiveness shown to someone who it is within one's power to punish or harm. Dylan is perhaps asking for mercy on this record, asking for redemption, looking for answers, as he always seems to be. This peaks in the song's bridge as he sings, "What good am I then to others and me if I've had every chance yet still fail to see? If my hands are tied, must I not wonder within who tied them and why, and where must I have been?" When Dylan writes the song, he's on a roll. He talks in his memoir Chronicles about a magic that emerges during the writing of this record. He seems to hit a purple patch out of almost nowhere. Different small inspirations seem to come to him, and he's quick enough to get them down onto paper. Now, of course, we can't take everything in Chronicles as gospel, as I said in the introduction to this episode. But Bob does play with the truth when he writes, and we know that. However, this does seem genuine. Dylan says he went to see a play by Eugene O'Neill called Long Day's Journey Into Night. Dylan apparently struggled with its subject matter. He called it hard to watch. Later, he stopped into a blues club, but when it came time to go home, he was walking back to his car along 4th Avenue and he saw a homeless man being ordered to move by the police. Dylan says that no one in that situation is happy. No one there has any pride about what's going on. Later, back at Dylan's house and in his art studio where he makes his ornate iron gate, he started writing What Good Am I? The entire song comes to him at once, like a bolt from the blue. He says it could have been anything from that night that sets off this creative rush. The homeless man, the cops, the blues club, the play. He says you see something in life that makes your heart turn rotten and you have to get it down without specifics. And so while I don't think this song is necessarily exclusively about that homeless man on 4th Street, it certainly seems triggered by what was going on there. I think Bob's certainly thinking about what type of people we are and what type of society we live in, but also what type of person he is. This is no great surprise, as Dylan's been thinking about his stuff for a while. In fact, you could argue a lot of this appears in the Born Again period. Here, though, he sings, "What good am I if I'm like all the rest? If I just turn away when I see how you're dressed? If I shut myself off so I can't hear you cry? What good am I?" Those lines feel achingly close to that 4th Street incident, as does, "What good am I if I know and don't do, if I see and don't say, if I look right through you, if I turn a deaf ear to the thundering sky, what good am I?" In the song, we hear our narrator hold a mirror up to themselves and inspect their worth. There's a constant you in the song that our narrator appeals to. In every verse, their plight seems to become more and more severe. In the first verse, Dylan talks of them crying. Then we hear of a thundering sky, like this is a natural, unstoppable, seismic problem that size is only continued onto the next verse's line of, "And I freeze in the moment, like the rest who don't try." Before, in the final verse, the you character in the song dies as our narrator turns his back. Probably not literally, but you get the point. Dylan sings, "What good am I if I say foolish things, and I laugh in the face of what sorrow brings? And if I turn my back while you silently die, what good am I?" It's the sort of questioning one finds themselves muttering in the small hours, perfect for this quiet O Mercy landscape. This is really a song of Dylan looking at the way the world works, how some are fortunate and some are not, and how that even with the good he's done in the world, our narrator is two parts of the problem. For me, the real sadness of the song really isn't the plight of the you mentioned here, perhaps that homeless man. But the sadness is no matter whether you are the homeless man or the you in this song in that desperate situation, or you are the narrator, you're really no better. You're either in that horrible situation or you're contributing to it in some way. The chords for this song are stunningly simple. Sure, there's a few little tricks going on, of course there is, but for the most part, Bob is going from the A to E chords, with some little noodling around these shapes in the form of a lick at the end of the first two lines in each verse. We then go up to the fourth frets for C sharp and G sharp a little later on, but mostly it's just that A and E chords, sounding a little bit like this. This goes back to what Lanois was saying earlier. They build that bass with Bob and then they can add and subtract. So they can add that twinkling piano sound or the dobro on or that stern bass, which is actually from Lanois. Or they can add something like Michael Burns' keys that gives us that late night organ sound in this song that runs through the track like ice water. Dylan was apparently a little disappointed with the song's melody. He says it wasn't special enough and didn't have that emotional impact. Lanois thought the melody was good enough, so Bob surrendered and they ended up completing the track. After this, they moved on to the song, Ring Them Bells. O Mercy is quite a religious record when you lift up the bonnet and take a look inside. Or at least it's a very spiritual record. And possibly its most spiritual moment is this track. Dylan and Lanois give us a piano ballad where Lanois' guitar reverb hits new reverby heights. And there's a lovely muted keyboard performance again from Malcolm Byrne. Just like we've seen a few times on O Mercy, there's a fair amount of concern here. Things seem to be beyond repair, recalling tracks like Everything is Broken and Political World. Dylan sings of a world on its side and a city that's dreaming, giving us the impression of an unawakened society, a place that's become lost. The opening lines are, "Ring them bells, ye heathen, from the city that dreams. Ring them bells from the sanctuaries, cross the valleys and streams. For they're deep and they're wide, and the world's on its side, and time is running backwards, and so is the bride." During live performances in 2004 and 2005, it's interesting to note that Dylan changes those lines to "the world's on its side, and there's nowhere to run, and there's nowhere left to hide." Now, the City of Dreams is a common name for Mumbai, which would link us to a line about a sacred cow that comes later on. But for me, it feels a little less specific than that. I feel like this is a city that's dreaming rather than a city of dreams. Although the song could be set in Mumbai, we just don't know. Either way, our narrator asks a heathen, someone who isn't engaged with religion, to ring them bells. This is continued throughout the song in various forms. He appears to ask them to ring it for the world they're currently in. It's the world that's on its side, a place where time is running backwards and so is the bride. This seems like a place where things aren't moving forward, where things are being propelled back to darker times. It's a world going backwards. As for the bride line, well, that could easily be a nod to Groom Still Waiting at the Altar, Bob's 1981 Shot of Love track, but also to Song of Solomon. Jewish scholars regarded the wedding of the bride and the groom as the love between God and the people of Israel. Christian theologists follow suit and saw the union between God and the church. Stephen Scobie, a Canadian poet, critic and scholar, argues this is linked to this song. He writes, "If, however, the groom is still waiting at the altar and the final battle of Armageddon has not been won, if time and bride are running backwards, then the world is moving catastrophically away from victory." So, like I say, we're on familiar ground here. The world is a mess and our narrator is worried for it. But unlike some other songs where we hear a worried man with a worried mind, here our narrator seems to be trying to unite the world. We've already heard him approach heathens, offering them some sort of olive branch. And in the following verses, Dylan addresses the direct opposite of a heathen. He calls St. Peter to ring the bells, singing, "Ring them bells, St. Peter, where the four winds blow." St. Peter was, of course, one of the 12 apostles of Jesus Christ. The four winds is a metaphor frequently used in the Bible. It usually represents spiritual truth. The four winds specifically refer to the whole of earth and heaven. They encompass all the corners of the earth and the sky, north, south, east, and west. And sure, the phrase can be used in a revelation-type judgmental way, but here it seems to be more of just a representation of being from God. There's not too much fire and brimstone here. This is sort of continued on to the next lines as Dylan sings, "Ring them bells with an iron hand so the people will know." The iron hand is a phrase that has come up before in Dylan's writing. In the track When He Returns, he sings, "The iron hand, it ain't match for the iron rod. The strongest wall will crumble and fall to a mighty God." That felt like a musing on the fact that man and the world we live in is no match for the glory of God. And so here, if we're in the same context, our narrator could be saying that mankind has to find their way to God. We have to ring the bells. We have to unite together, perhaps. If we're ringing the bells with an iron hand, perhaps we are doing God's work on earth with him. He finishes the verse with another mention of this world becoming less and less spiritual. Bob sings, "And the sun is going down upon the sacred cow." And in the next verse, this is coupled with, "Oh, the shepherd is asleep where the willows weep and the mountains are filled with lost sheep." The sheep line there could be alluding to the common use of flock in Western religion. A flock is defined as a group of followers of a religion or a religious leader. In the fourth verse, we get a little more needle introduced into the lyrics. But there's still an attempt to get people to join in this salvation. Dylan sings, "Ring them bells for the blind and the deaf. Ring them bells for all of us who are left. Ring them bells for the chosen few who will judge the many when the game is through. Ring them bells for the time that flies, for the child that cries when innocence dies." In the final verse, Dylan sings, "Ring them bells, St. Catherine, from the top of the room. Ring them for the fortress, for the lilies that bloom. Oh, the lines are long and the fighting is strong, and they're breaking down the distance between right and wrong." St. Catherine of Alexandria is potentially the St. Catherine at the start of his verse. According to tradition, she was a Christian saint and virgin who was martyred in the 4th century at the hands of the pagan emperor Maxentius. Since around the year 800, a tradition states that angels carried her to Mount Sinai. Dylan therefore speaks of ringing the bells from the top of the room. The end of the verse seems to sum up the song nicely, though. It talks of a struggle, perhaps a struggle for salvation or meaning. The final line is one that Bob has struggled with, though. He talks in his memoir Chronicles about finding that line difficult, struggling particularly with the right and wrong detailed within it. He was always apparently trying to correct the line. He says, "The concept of being morally right or morally wrong seems wired to the wrong frequency. Things that aren't in the script happen every day. If someone steals leather and then makes shoes for the poor, it might be a moral act, but it's legally not right, so it's wrong. A good person can do a bad thing, and a bad person can do a good thing." So perhaps Dylan feels the final moments of this song are a little black and white for his taste now. For me, while there's some apocalyptic imagery here, it is a hopeful song at its heart. In fact, it's perhaps even proactive in its hopefulness, and that's why in places Ring Them Bells takes on the form of a hymn. It's also an important moment on the entire O Mercy album. It feels like a true feeling is being captured on this song. Bob is very complimentary of Lanois' arrangement of it. He says, "Lanois put the magic into its heartbeat and pulse. We cut this song exactly the way I found it. Two or three takes with me on the piano, he definitely captured a moment. He might have even captured a whole era. He did the right thing and came up with a whole accurate dynamic vision. Anyone can hear that. The song sustains itself from beginning to end. Lanois brought out its keen harmonic sense. He was like a doctor. I asked him once if he was a doctor. He smiled and said, yeah, but not of medicine." It's a song that Lanois himself loves too. He shares the thoughts of Dylan there. In his autobiography, Soul Mining, he says, "Ring Them Bells is one of my favourites from the O Mercy album. A fantastic little vocal and piano performance from the man himself. There's something special about the cohesion of a one-point source when the piano and the vocal are done simultaneously. Bob performed Ring Them Bells on my rented Steinway B, which I later purchased and recently sold to John Cusack. He loves Ring Them Bells, and so now he has my piano in his place in Chicago." I do like the thought of John Cusack just rattling through Ring Them Bells casually in his living room. With the backbone of these two songs captured in that session, Lanois and Dylan managed to get O Mercy's creative juices flowing. And particularly with Ring Them Bells, they finished the session on a creative high for both the artist and the producer. Where they would go next would take them to the album's standout track, a song that would be one of Dylan's shining lights in over a decade. But they'd have to work for it, and that's something we look at next time.